It's impossible to mention the 18th century Scottish economist Adam Smith without mentioning the invisible hand he mentioned in his writing. He didn't mention it often, but it's the concept for which Adam Smith is best known, as in an invisible hand guides people to decisions in the market. That same hand can guide decisions that are not economic in nature. Is it God? Conscience? Something else? Economist Russ Roberts will let us know what he found in Smith's work. His book is How Adam Smith Can Change Your Life. Russ Roberts is based at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's a multimedia economist with three economics novels to his credit, a weekly podcast called Econ Talk, and a series of Keynes Hayek rap videos on YouTube. Russ Roberts, a pleasure to have you today on the Jefferson Exchange.
My pleasure.
You apparently had, or owned actually, the Adam Smith book that's at the core of your book for some time. Tell us about that.
Well, Adam Smith wrote two great books, and he always felt a little guilty. He wasn't more productive, but I think the rest of us would be thrilled to have written two books remotely like the two that he published. The first was actually The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which he published first in 1759, and then his famous book in the very auspicious year of 1776, which was an inquiry into the nature and causes of the wealth of nations. At the end of his life, 1790, the year he died, he issued a revised version. It was the sixth edition of The Theory of Moral Sentiments. So I like to say The Theory of Moral Sentiments was the book that was ever with him. And it's a book, it's a strange book, and I didn't read it for a long time. The reason it's a strange book is that it's a mix of economics, psychology, philosophy, preaching, and a lot of economists don't read it. The title doesn't suggest it's going to have much to do with economics. And finally, I got around to it in my 50s, which is a little bit late, but I'm glad I did. And it really, I found it to be an exhilarating read once I got started. It's not an easy book to jump into. There's a wonderful online version for listeners who want to read it without charge at the Library of Economics and Liberty. If you just Google Theory of Moral Sentiments, you'll find multiple versions of it available online. And Smith's language is a little bit daunting. The book's not particularly well organized. It's hard to know what he's talking about. But once you get into it, it's really an extraordinary look at human nature.
It sounds like you were feeling a little lukewarm about it in the first few chapters or so.
Yeah, well, I was interviewing a colleague at the time, Dan Klein, at George Mason University. I was at George Mason at the time, and he suggested we do an interview about it for my podcast. And I said, great, and I picked up the book. I thought, this is great. I'm going to finally have an excuse to read Adam Smith's other book. And I picked it up, and I read the first page, and I put it down because it wasn't so cheesy going. And I picked it up again, and I didn't really find it easy going again. I thought, let's just cancel this. But I eventually got the rhythm of it, and his language is beautiful. Smith writes remarkably well and accessibly for a modern of our time, although he's a little like Jane. I like to call him the Jane Austen of economics. Now, Jane Austen isn't everybody's cup of tea, that kind of writing style. We're a little more used to shorter sentences and smaller words today, for better or for worse. But once you get past that, there's a lot of delight in Smith.
Each of his books, as you point out, came from very different periods in the life of Adam Smith. Tell us about what was going on in his own life when he published, for example, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, and then what different happened as he got up to publishing The Wealth of Nations.
Well, I'm not sure much happened that was important. He had a pretty quiet life, and one of the things that's extraordinary about both books is he wasn't a terribly worldly person in the following sense. Now, he happened to be... in the following sense is that he was an academic. He spent a lot of time sitting in an armchair or sitting at a desk and thinking and writing and walking around. He was living at a good time in history, a time when Scotland was particularly dynamic, and I think he noticed that and it intrigued him. He had an extraordinary set of friends, including his best friend David Hume, the great philosopher. But a lot of what he learned wasn't field work. It wasn't laboratory work. He didn't have an MRI to study people's brains and neuroscience. He had a really good brain of his own and a chance to talk about his ideas with some really smart people. And most of his life was pretty quiet. He was an academic. He was a tutor for the Duke of Buccleuch, Scottish member of the nobility. He tutored the Duke's son. He took him over to Europe for a few years, and that's kind of the most worldly experience he had. He got to interact with great thinkers on the continent. But he wasn't a man of action, a dynamic person. He wasn't, as I said, a field researcher. He just was really, really smart, had an incredible sense of observation and a breadth of interest that shines through all his books.
Well, this really makes him ultimately more than an economist, but as you point out in the book, I mean, you're an economist, but say economics is about more than money.
Yeah, I one of the reasons I wrote the book was to redeem Adam Smith's reputation. I think a lot of people think of Smith as the ultimate economist, a person who said that greed is good and that greed leads to good things. And that actually was an idea that came before Smith in an economist called Mandeville. And Mandeville argued that sometimes greed leads to surprisingly good things. If you want to make a lot of money, for example, and you want to make a great product, that's one way to get really rich, is to make a great product with lots of customers and provide a good product at a good price. And that's well known. That was, Smith understood that. We still understand today we might not always like some of the time the effects of greed. We might not agree that it's good for you. We might disagree about its we might not be happy with its impact on our conscience or our soul. But that isn't what Smith was about. Smith was about the whole human experience. Yes, he was interested in what we would call self-interest, but that's not greed. In fact, the theory of moral sentiments, a huge part of it, is about warning people about the dangers of ambition and wealth. And I thought it was really important that Smith be understood in full.
Russ Roberts, to help us understand Adam Smith more, back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Economist Russ Roberts joined us in 2014 to talk about Adam Smith, the great Scottish economist of the Enlightenment. Russ's book examined the other ideas Smith was known for beyond economics. It's called How Adam Smith Can Change Your Life. Since the interview is all recorded, we can't sneak in any new phone calls or emails to the author today. Russ, do you have a copy of the book nearby?
I have a British edition, which is very different. I've got it right here.
Your own book,
The cover is different. The American edition has a bright yellow Adam Smith in sunglasses, and my publisher thought the British publisher thought that would not sell very well with the British audience. So it's a much more subdued, elegant, yes, but subdued cover. I have it in my hand.
The one with the sunglasses, the American edition, looks sort of like Elvis Costello in a wig.
I don't have any evidence of whether Smith could sing or whether he thought that angels wanted to wear his red shoes. But it is a little bit Costellian, yeah.
Well done. I wonder if you could make your way to page 3 and read us the 42 words about greed that would appear to contradict Ayn Rand.
Yeah, so Smith opens up. It's the first line of the book. He says, "How selfish soever man may be supposed, there are evidently some principles in his nature which interest him in the fortune of others and render their happiness necessary to him, though he derives nothing from it except the pleasure of seeing it." And that's how the book kicks off. He's trying to understand, why is it we're so self-interested, which we are, we're so self-centered, and yet we often act in ways that are not self-centered, not self-interested. We look out for other people, and of course we join with other people to do things. We're not atomistic, individualistic, selfish people. We love, it's a huge part of human experience. We love joining with others to do things, whether it's financial in starting a company or whether it's charitable or whether it's having a good time socializing. And that's what Smith's fascinated by. How do we interact with each other in a world where I can't really know exactly what the other person is thinking? And how do I then help other people when I want to, and why would I bother? And those are the questions that are a large chunk of the book.
So it goes way beyond enlightened self-interest into places where there really is no self-interest other than you get a smile and maybe a warm fuzzy out of it.
Well, he has a crazy example at the beginning of the book, or that I put at the beginning of my book, which is the idea that if you find out there's an earthquake in China that kills thousands and thousands of people, you're going to be very sad for a minute, and you might make a donation to charity, and you might worry about how people are going to cope, and then you're going to go on with your life. You're going to worry about your carpool or the project you're working on at work. And he says when you lay down at night to go to sleep, you're probably going to sleep pretty well, even though there are thousands of people sobbing and in desperate straits. And he contrasts that with, what if someone comes in and says, you're going to have your finger removed. You're going to have a little minor surgery, but you'll be fine. And he says the loss of your little finger creates a terrible emotional reaction, much stronger than the death of a million Chinese. And Smith then goes on. Some people stop there and say, oh, that's a cynical view of humanity. Unfortunately, for better or for worse, I think it's a somewhat accurate view. We tend to think about our own troubles more than the troubles of others. But then Smith asks the following question. If you could save your little finger by killing a million people, would you do it? And he says, of course not. Nobody would do that. And then he says, why? Why is it that when your emotional connection is so much stronger, do you care more about your finger? And he says, you realize that to put yourself first and put your little finger first is so grotesque, and you would be judged so harshly by people around you, and ultimately you'd be judged so harshly by yourself. Your own judgment, your self-judgment would be so negative at that behavior that you wouldn't even think about it for a minute. He said, it's too monstrous. And so what Smith is fascinated by is, where's my conscience come from? Why is it that I do the right thing? I don't always, of course. We're all flawed. We're all self-interested to some extent, some more than others. But why is it that sometimes we rise above that and we do the right thing? And Smith says it isn't because we're nice. He calls that a feeble spark. He says that's not enough. What really keeps us on the straight and narrow to the extent that we stay there is the judgment of those around us. And so a huge part of the book is what he calls, not a very helpful phrase, our moral sentiments, how we judge others, how we judge ourselves, and how they judge us and judge themselves. And that interaction, that dance, that it's almost, and he uses a musical metaphor often, that dance and harmony between people is a huge part of our lives.
Russ Roberts is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is How Adam Smith Can Change Your Life. So we it's the judgment of others we're concerned about. That's not necessarily something that comes from our reptile brains. I mean, did he make much differentiation between what was human and what was animal? And for that matter, did he believe in God? Did religion enter into this at all for Adam Smith?
Religion plays a role to some extent, but it's what's surprising is how eager he is to get God out of the equation in any direct way, for given that he was writing this in 1759 and onward to 1790. Right? You could have argued, well, people are worried about hell, they don't want to sin. He says he talks about that. He says it's not really the thing that motivates people. What really motivates them is the judgment not of God but of their fellows. And he argues that nature, he calls it God, he says the phrase he uses is the author of nature, presumably God, the author of nature put inside us this desire. And he says, my favorite line in the book, he says, man naturally desires not only to be loved, but to be lovely. And we have two things that drive us. One is we want to be loved, and by that he doesn't just mean romantically, he means admired, respected, paid attention to, praised. We want the approval of people around us, and we want to earn it honestly. We want to be lovely, and by that he means praiseworthy, worthy of respect, worthy of admiration. Because that's really what drives us, not money, although he says if we're not careful, we'll use money as a way to be loved. We'll try to get rich. He says the rich, the powerful, the famous, people hang on their words. They watch them when they come into a room. And he talks a lot in his book, ironically, for somebody writing in 1759, about celebrity and technology and gadgets of his day. These are things, he says, that motivate us to do things that aren't really so good for our souls, for ourselves, for our well-being. He says that they lead to imprudent behavior in our desire to accumulate money so that people will pay attention to us. But he definitely sees money, and again, this is strange for some people to hear coming from the author of The Wealth of Nations. He sees money as a trap. It's a way that will often do things that are very dishonorable, losing the respect of people around us, but in a way we hope it'll lead to people paying attention to us. And, of course, we do pay attention to the rich and famous and powerful. But his argument is that's the wrong way to go. You want to be paid attention to? He says be wise and be virtuous. And he spends a lot of time, and I try to do so in the book, trying to get some lessons for what it means to be virtuous, which is easy to say and harder to do.
There's something in here called the iron law of you. Is that Smith's term or yours?
That's mine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is you think more about yourself than other people do. you ask somebody for a favor, especially if it's a busy person, they don't respond right away, and your first thought is, oh my gosh, they're offended by the request, or they didn't like my whatever it was I had sent them, and they must hate it. And we often forget that for us, the world revolves around us. We think about ourselves most of the time, but other people think about themselves most of the time. So it's very hard to remember that the other people are busy. They've got stuff to do. They're thinking about themselves. And a lot of times when they don't do what you've asked them or the favor you've requested or the letter of recommendation or the guidance that you need, it's not because they don't agree with you or don't like you. It's just that they forgot. And so that's, again, one of the things that I think Smith is so powerful at is what psychologists call mindfulness, the idea of paying attention, the idea of being able to step outside yourself. And Smith, not on purpose, but indirectly gives us ways we can be mindful. We can step outside ourselves, look at our own behavior and improve it, or to understand what other people are thinking about us. And that's a very useful tool.
Russ Roberts, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an economist based at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's written a book in which he takes some analysis of Adam Smith's The Theory of Moral Sentiments from 1759. Russ's book is called How Adam Smith Can Change Your Life, An Unexpected Guide to Human Nature and Happiness. Here is Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Russ Roberts.
Yeah, hi, great show, and thanks, Russ, for writing your book. I hope it gets really wide circulation, the way Adam Smith has been captured by the right wing as needing correction for a long time. And I wonder if there was a book about 20 years ago that's been out of print, I'm sure, for a long, long time, but I thought the title sort of captured the dilemma of representing Adam Smith. The title of the book was Adam Smith's Mistake, How a Moral Philosopher Invented Economics and Ended Morality.
I don't know the book, but I think one of the things I'm trying to do in this book is push for a wider understanding of what economics is and what it should be concerned with. I've never believed that economics is just about money. I've never believed that GDP is the best measure of the quality of our lives, even of our lives on average. And Smith certainly would, I think, agree with that. And he wrote this other book that pushed a very different, I would describe it as a richer image of human beings than the more sterile economist one, which at times you do find.
Do you think his intention was that this was laying the groundwork for The Wealth of Nations? I mean, did he really intend for there to be a second book?
He really intended for there to be a third one. He wanted to write another book. He was a bit of a hypochondriac. He was, I think, often laid low by his worries and fears, and that kept him maybe from being as productive as he had hoped to be. He had a lot of notes and pages written at his death, and he ordered that they all be destroyed, and they all were. So we don't really know what he might have done if he had had a little more time to write that book. But I don't think he sat down and, you know, I don't think he thought about this. I don't think he had a grand plan, at least at the beginning, that he was going to ground economics in this. I think it's what he was interested in. I should point out that The Wealth of Nations, it covers a vast range of human experience beyond what we would also normally think of as economics. It's full of interesting observations about human nature. It just doesn't focus on these issues of psychology that we've been talking about that he does in The Theory of Moral Sentiments. But he was a highly, incredibly curious and thoughtful person and a person of incredible breadth. So that is what made both of his books so fascinating.
We have an email here from Mike in Medford. He says, I'm glad you're explaining the real Adam Smith, the one held hostage by, quote, liberal economic ideologists, or conservatives as they're called on this side of the pond. I once read Adam Smith saying the merchant class would be the worst class to rule. Can you explain this?
That's Smith talking?
Yeah, that's what he says.
Smith had a very jaundiced view of business in the following sense. He understood that people are self-interested. He took people as they are and not as he'd like them to be. And he famously said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that when people of business get together, they tend to conspire toward taking advantage of the public. And so he understood there was a risk of cartels and collusion, and he didn't have any romance about the merchant class. But he did believe, and we got to be fair to him, we don't want to go too far in the other direction, he very much believed that commerce, that trading, that interacting with people in business forced you to think a little bit, if not a lot, about what other people wanted and needed. He very explicitly says this early on in The Wealth of Nations. He says, if you want to make an exchange, a trade with someone, if you want to make a deal, think about what the other person, what's in it for the other person, not what's in it for you. And that's good advice, but he didn't just see that as good advice. I think he saw commerce as a civilizing force, a force that forced you to step outside yourself to some extent, at least in the commercial or material way. And I think he understood that more fully and wrote about it more fully in the book we're talking about, his book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, where he was interested in how people respond to grief and tragedy and success, how we share our successes or share our burdens with other people. And he was very interested in how, to what extent can we really do that? But he saw commerce as a way we do get out of ourselves. So he didn't have any romance, though, about business. He didn't see business as some glorious and wealth as anything glorious. He saw it often as unattractive, but he also saw politics that way too. He was very negative about the fawning and pandering that goes on among the powerful and among the wealthy. He was generally recommending we live quieter lives than most people aspire to.
Russ Roberts, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is How Adam Smith Can Change Your Life. You pull up some interesting choices of some of the wealthy and powerful in our time, Warren Buffett, Bernie Madoff, and Lance Armstrong among them. Is it fair to say that the negative examples, Bernie Madoff and Lance Armstrong, are a bit more vivid to us?
That Smith makes them more vivid?
No, that we find them more vivid in our time.
Oh, I don't know about that. What's fascinating to me is how much there is about celebrity in Smith's book, and we tend to think of celebrity and reality TV and the 15 minutes of fame.
The Kardashians.
It's a very modern phenomenon. It's for better or for worse, it's timeless. Smith writes about the famous of his day with quite a bit of disdain and lack of respect. I think what's different about today, and what's, I should add that the reason Smith tried to explain why we're so fascinated with celebrity and why in particular, and it's a great insight, he says, when a rich or famous or powerful person dies, we're so much sadder than often we are with people who are closer than that to us, that we know better. And he viewed the way that people follow the famous and he called them the great. He didn't mean that in the admirable sense. He just meant they're outsized, they're
bigger
larger
than us,
in
yeah.
life. He says, we follow them, and then we have this beautiful image that their lives are perfect, and that their fairy tale ending should never end. It should never end unhappily with death, and yet of course it does. And he talks about how we don't want to face that. And to me, that explains why we have things like Princess Di and Elvis Presley and Whitney Houston, the outpouring of grief that's so outsized and so large. And Smith was basically saying that that's very human, but he's also saying it's not something you should aspire to. You shouldn't aspire toward fame and fortune and power because it corrupts you ultimately. And he's very negative about those things. But so that hasn't changed. What's different today, of course, is that our ability to imagine their lives is so much fuller, unfortunately, to me, today than it was in 1759. 1759, you saw a rich person in fancy clothes go by in a carriage, and you saw them go into a very large house, perhaps, and you thought, well, they must have a perfect life. And Smith says, actually, they don't. That was in his day. In our day, we don't just get to see them going by in a carriage, right? We get a reality TV show, which sometimes shows us the warts, but oftentimes gives us an incredibly distorted picture of what life is like for a Hollywood star, for example, and how their lives, we have such romance about them and such eagerness to share in them. Athletes, rock stars, performers, actors, actresses, we see them as so grand And Smith basically saying, you know, they put their pants on one leg at a time, like the rest of us. And to get where they are, they had to step on a lot of people, and they're really not so enviable. And so Smith's really warning us about the dangers of that kind of worship. And I think in our time, that vividness you're talking about comes from the fact that we know so much more that's mostly positive, distorted, positive about their lives.
Russ Roberts, the author of How Adam Smith Can Change Your Life, An Unexpected Guide to Human Nature and Happiness. We'll plumb more depths of Adam Smith, who was much more than an economist, when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Who knew Adam Smith, the great Scottish economist, was about so much more than just markets and the invisible hand? Well, Russ Roberts, himself an economist, figured it out and wrote the book How Adam Smith Can Change Your Life, An Unexpected Guide to Human Nature and Happiness. It's based on Adam Smith's book, The Theory of Modern Sentiments. This is all recorded back in 2014, so we can't take any new phone calls or emails. Here again is Russ. Russ, it's quite a lovely scene you rewrite in the book of imagining visiting Adam Smith at his home. What would you like to ask him, assuming a limited amount of time?
Well, in the book I write about the fact that here's this man who wrote so eloquently about the dangers of seeking fame and seeking wealth. And in his own life, he was very comfortable financially, and he became extremely famous. There aren't that many people who wrote books in 1759 who get talked about on public radio in 2014. So his celebrity is rather remarkable. And so one of the things I'd like to ask him is, does that change his views? And I think his response would have been that, well, nothing really wrong with being wealthy. It's probably better than the alternative. But what's wrong is to pursue it for its own sake, to pursue money for its own sake, fame for its own sake. And in fact, he talked, in my mind, foreshadowing some of the excesses of social media. He talks about people who use what he calls the quackish arts to attract attention to themselves, the embarrassing things that people do to be noticed and to be fawned over and talked about. And I think one of his messages is one of his virtues is prudence. And by that he meant taking care of oneself, not doing ridiculous, reckless things with your life or your money or your family. And I think he was onto something there. He's a very wise man.
Well, in his eyes, if you're in good health, out of debt, and your conscience is clear, you're pretty much set.
Yeah, and he wrote, again, at a time when I don't think he could have possibly imagined the prosperity that many people in the modern world are able to enjoy. The comfort they're able to enjoy. And although I concede in the book that gadgets can sometimes control my life and be a huge addiction and a waste of time if you're not careful, I also point out that there are a lot of gadgets in our time that are incredibly satisfying and pleasant to use, and they're often used in ways that connect us to other people. So you don't know if he'd have the exact same judgments today that he had then, but I think he was really talking about, to some extent, moderation. Not getting overly obsessed with any of these things we've been talking about, money, wealth, power.
What kinds of gadgets was he talking about in his own time?
It's hard to believe there were any. They didn't have that many iPhones in 1750, smartphones, GPSs.
Just the old Motorola flip phone, right?
Yeah. No, it's even more primitive than that, of course. But he talks about them, which is pretty funny. He talks about an ear picker. And I got online and looked at some pictures of some. You don't really want to look at it. I discourage listeners from checking out an ear picker on Google, but people thought that was evidently a tool you wanted to have around. He talks about a machine for cutting the nails, some kind of nail clipper of his day. And he talked about how people like to show them off and carry them around with them and have special cases for them. And I thought, oh, boy, is that nothing's changed since 1759. We do like to carry those things around. We do like to show them off. And the example he actually uses, which is very timely, literally, is a watch. He says, you know, a person will have a watch that's off, that loses a couple of minutes a day, and then they'll spend a big large amount of money to get a watch that tells much better time. He says, but doesn't make them any more punctual. They still miss meetings. And he says, what's the good of that? Why would you want a better watch if it doesn't get you on time more often? And I thought, how perfect it is that when Tim Cook announced the Apple Watch, the very first thing he said was how accurate it was. And I'm thinking, you mean my iPhone, which is, what, off by 20, 25 seconds maybe sometimes? That's not accurate enough? For most of us, it's plenty accurate. But he says, we love the idea that we can create things that do their jobs so well, even if it doesn't help us do our job that well. And again, that's just, nothing's changed since 1759 there.
Did he have a sense of what, I mean, did he ever use the term virtuous? I guess that's one thing I'm listening for here, and I'm not hearing it.
Oh, all the time. Mm-hmm. He was very interested in two things, propriety and virtue. And by propriety, he meant meeting other people's expectations, doing the right thing, doing the proper thing, doing the expected thing so other people can do their expected thing, not be thrown off, not be surprised. He says, for example, when there's a tragedy and a death, you can't experience the way your neighbor experiences it personally, but you can try. You get closer than you might otherwise by trying. And your neighbor, who's experienced the death, the neighbor lowers his grief level so that, because he knows you can't feel it as strongly as he does. And by that, you know, he's talking about how we, in responding to other people, particularly even to strangers, we can be in a better mood with a stranger than we often are with a friend, because with a friend we can bare our soul. We can talk about how depressed we are. With a stranger, we're trying to cover it up. And he understands that just very, very beautifully. But that's propriety. That's the minimum standard. To really be lovely, which was his gold standard, you had to have virtue. And his big three virtues were prudence, justice, and beneficence. By prudence, he meant not being reckless with yourself, your health, your money, your time. By justice, he meant not hurting other people, obvious things like not stealing or physically hurting people. And beneficence, which is the toughest of the three, beneficence means helping other people, not trying to help other people, actually helping other people. And he spends quite a bit of time, and I spend a little bit of time in my book, trying to give an idea of how you'd actually implement that rather than just say, oh, it's easy, just be a nice person. Smith understood that that's much more harder to do than it actually sounds.
I wonder about Adam Smith himself, though, about its important. Man naturally desires not only to be loved, but to be lovely. I mean, and it seems like he certainly was lovely in his time and certainly beyond it. But was he loved? He died a bachelor, didn't he?
He did. He was there's some talk that he had some romantic, fling would be too strong a word, romantic interest when he was on the continent, when he was in Europe with his the young charge he was tutoring, the son of the Duke of Buccleuch. But he lived most of his life with his mom. He was a very good friend. He was, I think, an effective and beloved teacher. And but he didn't know a lot about women. One of the things he says, for example, is that he can't understand why women put on makeup. He said, because it's not really them. You might admire a woman's skin, he says, or her face, but it's not really her. It's the makeup. And I think he didn't fully appreciate plastic surgery for men or women that we have today, or the other ways that people try to enhance their physical appearance. But he was a little more pragmatic, I guess, a little more down to earth.
You know, I'm thinking about some of the other stuff you write about in the book about people who do things or at least say things to appear selfless, like the people who quit major jobs because they want to spend more time with their families. And yet, when another job comes along, suddenly their family is a lot less important.
Yeah.
And what do you attribute that to, or what do you and Adam Smith jointly attribute that to?
Well, that's one of the things I learned from Smith that's, you know, helps me understand certainly myself and sometimes perhaps other people. I've always, you know, when the football coach says or the politician says I'm quitting to spend more time with my family, I've always thought, yeah, that's just, he's just posing. He's just trying to make us think he's a nice person. And that's part of our desire to be lovely. He's trying to get and to be loved. He wants the person stepping down wants us to think that they're more virtuous than they actually are. But then the more I thought about it, the more I realized that part of what Smith's talking about is self-deception. And that a person will often, all of us often will say things. It's not just to make other people think that we're better than we are. We also want to think better of ourselves than we really are. And when you start to think about that, it's difficult to do because we want to We want to be lovely, and as I point out in the book, we want other people, even if we're not lovely, we want to think we're lovely. We like the idea that we're virtuous and good and basically fine, and you know, murderers can convince themselves that they really didn't do anything wrong. And that shows you how powerful the urge to be thought of as lovely actually is. And Smith understood that. He wrote about it. He wrote about it very well. And he says this self-deception is responsible for half the disorders of modern life. And I suggested maybe that's an underestimate of the proportion. Obviously, we fool ourselves all the time. And so you know, I have a chapter in there on self-deception. We deceive ourselves about our morality, the way we treat our friends, our family, our spouse, our political views. Somehow the other guy, the other person who's always got bad motives, we're pure. But the other side, you know, we're talking on election day.
Right.
The other side's evil. I'm noble and public-spirited. But the other side, oh, they're terrible. They're always. And it's amazing that both sides think the same thing. One of them is, and maybe both of them are wrong. I think, an important lesson in life to remember that we're capable of self-deception.
Well, and as you point out, I mean, we often tend to notice the flaws in others just fine.
So easily, yeah. He has a great line there. He says, bold is the surgeon who does not hesitate to operate on his own person, which is an incredible line. So we see it. We can operate on other people. You want me to take out the things that are wrong with you? Want me to diagnose your problems? I'm fabulous at that. Diagnose them out? Well, I mean, I'm fine. I don't really have any big failings I need to work on. You, on the other hand. So Smith understood that, and he gives you some ways to think about how you might be a little more honest about yourself, which I think generally is a good thing. We all need a little bit of self-deception to get by. He talks about the mysterious veil of self-delusion that we cover our deformities with, and he doesn't mean our physical deformities. He means our emotional or moral deformities, and I think some of them are better exposed than not, but a few of them we probably are best to keep them in the dark, even from ourselves. So it's better that we think well of ourselves in some dimension. But he does remind us that if we want to be better people, if we want to be better friends, better family, better spouses, better colleagues at work, he does talk about ways that we might improve on that.
So, Russ, you were just talking about in the political realm, for example, the way that the other side's always wrong, for example. And then this extends into your own field, as you point out in the book, in economics, which, of course, is referred to as a science, the dismal science. And yet people in the field disagree so vehemently. And as you point out, if really there's no definitive study that would make other economists say, oh, you're right.
Yeah, I think that the disagreement, I don't find it, it shouldn't be surprising that we disagree over principles, right? You might think the government should be bigger, I might think government should be smaller, and those are very fundamental questions of philosophy, ideology, and morality that we all have a wide range of opinions on. But this idea that somehow the effects of the stimulus, or what we ought to do right now with interest rates, or what's the cause of our unemployment level not being where it should be, or why is the economy growing more slowly? These are the questions that economics should try to answer. And unfortunately, in my view, and I'm a minority here, most economists are very confident in their ability to explain those things. Their evidence for them, I argue, is very weak for their opinions. But in my view, those are questions that aren't really worked out easily by science. I wish they were. I know economists are supposed to be able to answer those questions. I was once asked how many jobs did NAFTA create? And I said, I have no idea. And this is a journalist. He said, well, but that's your job. Your job is to tell us that. And I said, or how many did it destroy? Net, what's the net effect of NAFTA on employment? And I said, I have no idea. And he said, but that's your job. You're being dishonest with me. I said, no, I'm being honest. You just don't like the answer. Economists can't answer that question, not even to forget to the first decimal point. You know, people, well, 300,756. It's not even 300,000. It's not 3,756. We don't have the statistical tools to answer those questions, but we try. And then we announce the answers. We pronounce them with such great confidence because that's how, of course, you get attention, through confidence and through boldness and precision. And yet, so often, the economists who make awful predictions pay no price for it. They continue to be interviewed and quoted, and I just wish we were a little more humble, a little quieter, and stuck with what I think we're better at doing, which is understanding that there are trade-offs in the world, understanding that the world's a complicated place, but stop trying to pretend that we can steer the economy with any precision or predict its impact of a policy to the level that we often claim we do.
What kind of response have you gotten from fellow economists about turning Adam Smith into something like a self-help guru?
Yeah, it's a little bit degrading, isn't it? Most of my colleagues are people who are interested. The ones I talk to are the ones who like Adam Smith, and they're pretty happy that his other book is going to get a little bit of attention, I think. I think that's okay. But I am very much in the minority in my view about what I think is the hubris of the profession in making claims for scientific precision. Most of the economists I interview will tell me that we just need more time. We just need more data.
Uh-huh.
And my view is these are problems that I don't think any amount of data or time are going to help us solve, and we should just be more honest.
Well, we certainly learn a lot in the book, both from Adam Smith and from you. Russ Roberts wrote How Adam Smith Can Change Your Life. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.